Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From newsounds.org and the studios of WNYC in New York, it's time for another live performance in our Soundcheck podcast series. Streaming live on Facebook and YouTube, I'm John Schaefer. Over the course of about four decades of making music, Thurston Moore has done a lot of things. Guitarist, composer, improviser, collaborator, co-founder, of course, of the path-breaking rock band Sonic Youth. So he's never lacked for ambition, but his current project might be his most ambitious yet. It's a three CD set. Each CD consists of a single, expansive, guitar-driven sonic meditation. It's called Spirit Council, and it brings Thurston Moore and his trio back to our studio. Thurston, good to see you.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here again.
So the title Spirit Council kind of gives the game away, doesn't it, a little bit?
Well, it matters what game you're talking about. What are you alluding to here?
you're talking about a set of pieces that have apparently different sources of inspiration, but there is this kind of overarching idea that ties them together.
I've always been very attracted and informed and intrigued by like spirit music. It sort of led me really into jazz music. And I got into jazz music a bit late in my life. I was in my late 20s, in the 80s, after coming into music via classical music in my household and then through radical rock and roll music, and really finding really alluring the music that was on the margins, be it Iggy and the Stooges, be it the Velvet Underground and all these players that we all are so kind of attuned to now, that are kind of more sort of conventional names. But at the time in the early mid 70s, they were outliers.
Right.
I think Iggy Pop always thought like maybe three people bought a Stooges record, but those three people started the Ramones, right? So it's this kind of thing. So anyway, I always thought experimental music. I always thought punk rock music was experimental music, and subsequently I thought those musics were very spirit-driven musics. It had as its primary focus the human condition more so than any kind of academic technique. But I thought it also was, in regard to anything and everything, it was a very liberated music. And so I thought a lot of people who were working in the realm of new music, punk rock music, 20th century composition music coming out of the academies, all had a sense of just daring and wanting to challenge themselves, which is a very spiritual kind of demeanor, more than anything. And so that's what I was always attracted to. And jazz music sort of brought me into that deeper, going into just the diaspora of African-American music and into other musics, dare I say, ethnic musics, away from what I was experiencing.
Yeah. One of the longest of the three pieces on Spirit Council is a work called Alice Smokey Jane. Alice refers to Alice Coltrane.
Yes.
And in sort of in retrospect, we have labeled what she did, what John Coltrane did late in his career, Pharoah Sanders, people like that. We've labeled that spiritual jazz.
Yeah, it is a label, but it is truly spiritual music. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, be it jazz or what have you. I mean, Alice Coltrane and a lot of her music making as the director of the ashram she was involved with, her music was just completely devotional music. She referred to it as devotional songs.
Right.
And whether it has how relative it is to the idiom of jazz, you maybe not wouldn't know that by listening to it. It is truly Dharma music.
Thank you. but blended with the gospel and jazz that she grew up listening to in Detroit.
Oh, yeah,
so it's this amazing hybrid. Yeah.
The first CD in the box is called Alice Smokey Jane, and it basically there's a bit of a guitar motif that introduces the piece before it unfolds. And when I played it, it reminded me of a very simple line in one of the devotional songs that I had heard in Alice Coltrane's music. And so I was just going to dedicate it more than title it, but I didn't have a title, and so I was I took it upon myself just to title it Alice Milky Jane, because I was talking to Nana Cherry, the daughter of Moki Cherry, about this, and she said, "Oh, Moki and Alice were friendly, and they were friends." I was like, "Oh, that's really interesting." I mean, these two women who their partners were these high profile jazz musicians, and
John Coltrane and Don Cherry.
Don Cherry, and then Jane Cortez was also a friend of theirs. So there was a bit of a triumvirate of these visionary artists who had these high profile partners in there, and they, as women, didn't really have that space be
and Jane's partner, just to complete the trilogy.
Jane Cortez was in partnership with Ornette Coleman,
right?
And she was a poet, an African American female poet of very strong resistance poetry and resilience poetry, and just beautiful poetry of the self. So I wanted to dedicate the piece to the three of them after this conversation, and I just called it Alice Moki Jane. Moki Cherry, I had met once in the 80s, in the mid-80s. She was a friend of a friend, somebody I was working for, scraping ceilings for some loose coin. And
who was? You or
she? I was. She was not. But I had met her somewhere through this friend. I was at her apartment in Brooklyn, and I was talking about how I wanted to do an album cover for this record called Bad Moon Rising by my band Sonic Youth, and I had this idea of a burning jack-o'-lantern head on top of a scarecrow in a field, but there's really no fields that I can find in New York that would allow me to do this with any permission. And she said, "Well, I live in Williamsburg," and at this time Williamsburg was fairly strafed.
Yes,
there wasn't much of a population there.
Nothing like it is now.
And she said, "I have a backyard. Don and I live in this building, and you're welcome to use it." And so the band went there with the photographer James Welling, and he shot this photograph in the back of the Cherry residence at the time.
Wow. Okay. But now, the piece that you and James Edwards and John Leidecker are here to play for us today is a different piece, and it's called simply 8 Spring Street.
Yes.
Which is not so far from here.
No.
It was the address of the late American composer and electric guitarist,
Glenn Branca.
So, now Glenn was famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, for these symphonies that he wrote for small armies of electric guitars.
Mm-hmm.
But they were deeply spiritual pieces. I mean, the titles, Gloria, The Ascension, The Peak of the Sacred.
Glenn, like a lot of musicians that I was very entranced by, was he was wanting to attain some kind of transcendence through his work, and for me that's a great thing to be engaged with. I mean, it's like that search where there is no beginning, there is no end. You're just sort of in the moment, and it's to be shared. And he shared his experience of his work. I was attracted to Glenn as a guitar player because he was not coming out of a lineage of high technique guitar playing, but I think he certainly had a recognition of it and was able to balance that recognition with his own forays into doing alternate tunings of the guitar away from traditional tunings and experimenting thus. When I first saw him play, I mean, I saw his groups early on in the 70s, in the late 70s. He had a group called Theoretical Girls.
Right.
And then the Static. And I was in a group called The Coachmen, and we had played with the Static a couple of times at different little places in downtown. And I didn't know what to think of them. They were fairly impenetrable, as you know, these groups, and no wave, just like abrasive and just pretty aggressive. And with a lot of those groups, it was a little hard to sort of be in the same room sometimes. But you know, mostly in retrospect, I'm so happy to have been there. But it wasn't until I saw him play under his own name, and he had it was a sextet. It was himself and five other guitarists and a drummer.
Was Lee playing with him?
Lee wasn't in the group at that point.
At that point, okay.
And
he was
accomplishing something that I had sort of like been thinking about, or just like it was contemplating, like this kind of this sound that had sort of this the veracity of what I was hearing in a lot of punk rock and with just these experimental ideas of what guitar music can sound like. And there it was. It was in this room.
Yeah.
And I realized at some point that what he was doing was each guitar was tuned to one of the strings in a traditionally tuned guitar. So he had like all the low E string it, all the high E string it, all the G string, all in six string guitars. I believe that's what was happening. Maybe James would know more better than I. James knows more about guitar music than I do. But I.
Well, I mean, he did many different
sort
of alternative approaches to the guitar, including by the end building his own sort of coffin shaped what he called guitars that were, you know, tuned not
Glenn
in the Western scale at all.
You know, Glenn came out of theater. You know, he came out down from Boston. He was in the Bastard Theater in the early 70s. He had a real sense of performance.
Yes.
He had a real sense of a visual aesthetic that was really interesting. So for him, the presentation of what he was doing was really key.
Yeah.
Had his equal value to the music he was presenting was what he presented as a musician, what he thought that should look like, what a band should look like. He was really into Aerosmith in Boston. He used to tell me like the way they looked and how they came out and what, you know, and so that kind of rock and roll swagger entered into his interest in, say, like the lineage of like New York minimalism with like Steve Reich and Philip Glass,
right.
You know, which was music was very important to him, that idea of minimalism creating transcendence through minimalism, through repetition
and also through tuning and by tuning lots of strings to the same note, you get all these overtones reinforced, especially at high volume. Is that happening in this piece, in 8 Spring Street?
This piece is in reference to, it's an honorific to Glenn. I would hardly say it's attaining what he was so studious about with like alternate tunings, trying to create that kind of experience. Oh, maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
I there are moments here where on the recording, at least, we'll see what happens now in live performance. But there are moments where you create these sort of, as the minimalist composer Lamont Young would call them, clouds of overtones, which, I mean, that's what Glenn was all about.
Yeah.
And
I wrote about this in the liner notes on Spirit Council, where Glenn had a box fan in his window at 8 Spring Street. And that's how we kept cool in the summer, when you were like a poor noise artist.
Yep.
You had a box fan in the window. And there was overtones being created by those fan blades. And he would seriously like, I want to be the manifestation of those fan blades. You know? It was as simple and beautiful as that. You know?
Yeah.
It was truly like urban poetry music.
All right. So this piece, 8 Spring Street, is on the latest album by Thurston Moore called Spirit Council. James Edwards is here. John Leidecker's got the electronics. You and James have the guitars.
This trio is a truncation of a quintet. I mean, we perform the three of us with Deb Googe. She plays six-string octave electric bass. Yeah. And Steve Shelley is our drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we perform live. But this piece can be performed in different contexts. And so today, yes, we're doing two guitars and electronics.
You guys ready to play the
piece?
Yes,
we are.
All right. This is music from Thurston Moore, and it's from his 3-CD set called Spirit Council. Here is a live performance of 8 Spring Street.
Thank you.
That is a single live performance on this edition of our Soundcheck podcast series in our New Sound studio. The piece by Thurston Moore is called 8 Spring Street, which was the address of the late American guitarist and composer Glenn Branca. You heard Thurston Moore playing guitar in your right channel, if you're listening in stereo, James Edwards playing guitar in your left channel, and John Lydecker's electronics were all over the place in the stereo field there. And Thurston, one of the things that characterized Glenn Branca's music and your music with Sonic Youth and beyond is the use of alternate tunings. What is the tuning that you're using on that guitar there?
You want me to give the secrets away. That's what you're saying. No, I'm into complete demythologization of the tuning systems of our guitars. That's me speaking in electronic lexicon right there. It's a D-sharp, D-sharp, right? Yeah. James, because I have it written differently here. This is not correct. Oh, I love it. D-sharp, D-sharp, A-sharp, C.
A-sharp again.
D-sharp, D-sharp, A-sharp, A-sharp, C.
Sharp.
Sharp, D-sharp. So it's all sharps.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and the point of having two strings with the same tuning and then two more strings with the same tuning, a fifth above, is everything reinforces itself.
They're partners. I mean, you know, it's it's two, you know, it's power in numbers, safety in numbers.
And you
know, they're pairs. I mean, it's basically, it creates that much more of an open drone tuning to work with. For me, I've never really got into tuning systems, if you want to call them, with any real sort of kind of preordained academic kind of approach.
Right.
It's really just, it's completely sentient. I will play openly without noting the guitar, and I will tune the tuning pegs to what I think is a interesting open chord, and then I'll modify it.
Right.
As I become more, you know, into it. So.
And of course, all those open strings, very resonant, lots of overtones and stuff. You get a really rich sound out of
that. And becoming aware of just sort of, I mean, the history of alternate tunings in different musics, you know, be it country blues guitar tunings, of which, you know, people like Keith Richards would come out and sort of, you know, and explore things that Lou Reed and was doing in the Velvet Underground, certainly. These were all things that you would sort of find out in retrospect of as you got involved with it. At least I did in the mid to late 70s. And these things became astounding pieces of information that when you realized what was going on with other groups.
Well, and here's one of the great things. I mean, I mentioned the minimalist composer Lamont Young earlier. You mentioned Lou Reed. And, you know, those are two names that you might think of as completely separate entities, musically speaking. And yet, you know, all of these things come together. There's so much in common between apparently dissimilar types of music.
It's of a time, you know. I think there's something in the water in a way. I think, to speak, as musical language develops, it's especially, you know, in our neighborhood of, like, you know, North America, the Western civilization, and hearing modern music. It's interesting to hear the similarity of ideas and concepts that happen in certain places, and they're not really coming out of a void. There's a lot of, I think, elemental and experiential and environmental sharing going on.
Yeah.
So when the Ramones are playing like their music, which is like this really minimalist guitar music, I think I had mentioned somewhere that, you know, it was really happening at the same time when a lot of interest in minimalist work was happening with Steve Reich and Philip Glass. And I don't think the Ramones were going to Alice Tolley Hall and listening to Philip Glass, or even if they had any awareness of that. But they probably did. We all read the Village Voice at the same time.
Right. Well, you know, there's also that sense of music as a ladder to something transcendent, to something beyond. And that, I think most musicians feel that at some deep level. So that's kind of, it seems to be at the heart of this new 3-CD set called Spirit Council. And that set is out. Thurston Moore and the band now touring around.
Yes.
It's the quintet version.
That's right.
how long do you play? I mean, you got 2.5 hours of music on the records.
We just keep playing until the place empties out. I mean, seriously, I mean, sometimes we will play, like, we'll play a couple of these pieces, and one piece will end where it will get into sort of just looping mechanisms. It's just, it's completely beautiful. And we'll just sort of sit back and watch the instruments play, and then we'll just go off to the side of the stage, and we'll let it play until somebody in charge comes up.
Pulls the plug.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, this has been great having you back in the studio and to hear some of this remarkable music. Thurston Moore, my guest, this is Soundcheck. That'll do it for this edition of the Soundcheck podcast, but as always, there's much more to be found on our website. Lots of other performances, video shot in the studio, the daily gig alerts, weekly music roundups, new sound shows, and more. Check it out at newsounds.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.